Okay, this is tape two of the John Sater interview on the 25th of October, 2001. We were talking about Prudhoe Bay.
Prudhoe Bay, yeah. Well, our work, we relieved a lot of feelings and angst on people, but our forecasts were only, I think, moderately valuable to them. Fortunately, the gods did not send them another summer like that one. Our hindcast was fantastic. Once we looked at the data, we could have told them in March of that year what they were going to get clobbered with.
Was that
come August.
Summer of 75?
I've forgotten what the year
is. That's when we had Ajax out. The ice blew up against the North Slope. Yeah, I was a sealed barrel. I had a message from Preston Ford direct. Bypassed the whole chain of command. He says, you have my order to use all of your icebreakers. I had none. All of your ships. All of your aircraft.
Yeah, two.
Two. Well, I had two R-40s. I had 10 aircraft.
Two R-40s.
Two R-40s.
Okay.
Four.
Oh, yeah, an Air Force.
Cessna 180s. And to get the fleet over. You were doing forecasts for the oil companies for AINA. I guess I ought to back up. You took over when for AINA here? From
I took over from Bob. I don't know when it was. Somewhere in there. Somewhere in the 70s.
And that was when you were in Arlington, when you took it. Okay. So, did you have staff here? One man office?
Not much,
mm-hmm.
No.
Secretary?
A couple of secretaries. Well, people to help with the forecast and
mm-hmm.
get it together and fax it out to the
mm-hmm.
all the anxious, angst-ridden CEOs and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But quite small. The and then I closed it. I just got tired of it was the only money coming in to the office. And I got the feeling that we weren't supplying the companies with relevant data. It was hand-holding, but not more. So I just closed the office and turned the contract over to Bill Dean. And
Bill Dean being?
He was the sea ice man.
But where was he? Who was
he? He was based in Suitland.
Okay.
Because he...
Okay.
Well, that's why I say I think he'd been ice patrol background. That was where he got his stripes.
Mm-hmm.
Navy ice patrol type out of Iceland and that
mm-hmm.
sort of
oh,
jazz.
Okay. Yeah. He wasn't Coast Guard?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't
no,
Coast
he wasn't Coast Guard, no.
In
he
Navy.
Was
okay.
Navy. Ron can tell you.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently, when they entered in the new contract, when I turned it over to Bill, the oil companies were thinking along the same lines. And they wrote a different contract from the one they'd given to Walt and I. And I found out about this indirectly, but there was something, there was a penalty clause.
If the forecast wasn't good?
Right. Or something in that order of magnitude. And it brought Dean up short, and he had to go out of business. So, well, he had lost Walt and
mm-hmm.
Walt's knowledge of ice, and he had lost the
so he didn't do a good
computer
job.
Meteorologist. so forth.
He didn't do a good job.
Well, and the seasons changed.
Yeah.
And the company's improved.
Mm-hmm. They learned to do their own.
And I suppose they're doing it on their own now. I haven't followed.
Gee, that stuff coming out of Superman is really good. You just pull it right off the computer website.
Well, anyway, that was it. So I closed the place down roughly in 80. One thing to go back.
Closed ANA in 1980 or thereabouts, and then you wanted to back up even before the phone rang.
It was during the winter I was on Arliss too. It taught Brewer and Schindler never to fly on the same airplane. The island had been initiated by Icebreaker that summer, and they had left a cache of fuel drums. And by October, they were pretty well covered with rime. There was a great whacking stack of diesel in one place, and there was a smaller stack of avgas in another. And Max and John came out, and what was his name? Zimmerman was the pilot on the DC-3. To see how I was doing and kiss us goodbye before winter fell in total darkness and so forth. And the mechanic, Frankie Ockbeck, rolled a couple of drums of avgas out of the stash and topped up the tanks on the plane, and we all had coffee and kissed each other goodbye and so forth, and I left the beacon on for about an hour, and then figured what the hell, turned it off. Well, in the meantime, Zimmerman had himself some engine problems, and one of his engines gave out because they suspect a mechanical problem of some sort or another. So he just switched to the other tank. Unfortunately, we had loaded diesel fuel. And somewhere between Wrangell Island and Barrow, Zim had to put down in the dark on the pack. And in the meantime, I had gone down to roll the empties off to whatever we did with empties. We put them in another stack and happened to realize that we had put the diesel in. Read the stencil on the top of the can and radioed to Barrow, let them know. And then began the big search for the bosses. And it was a quick way to get a promotion in my job, you know, because I would have been third in line and taken over the lab. But It didn't work. They found him. DC-7's out of Elmendorf.
So therefore set up a search.
Mm-hmm. Set up a search and brought in a four-engine bird to pick him up.
Landed on the ice?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. How was the R-4D? Did they belly it in?
Yeah.
So they damaged it when they landed. Yeah, okay.
It was so rough that he didn't have, I don't think he had any alternative.
Oh yeah,
because he didn't have that much chance to look around. He simply had to put it down where he was when he lost power.
It's standard procedure if you're going to make a rough terrain landing. You just want to get down and save your life. Your chances are a lot better if you leave the gear up, because you're liable to nose over.
Well, and no power.
Well, you can nose over. If it's a nice flat runway, you can go in on your wheel. You know, or if you could find a refrozen weed that would look thick enough, you. Yeah. Landed on your wheel. So we had a guy with a C-130 Air Force, Antarctica, first C-130's down there, Air National Guard, lost all four engines. Of course, he's got the whole Ross Ice, big flat, no crevasses apparent. So he puts the skis down. Now, C-130's. Easy to belly in. That's just an easy plane. To belly in, if you want to save your life, but he wants to save the aircraft too, so he did. And they skied down. They're all right, what have you. It turned out there was a mechanical change needed for cold weather ops in the engines. They fixed the engines and flew it out later. So that's pretty rare. I think most guys would probably elect to just put it down and get out of camp, let somebody come get them. So, it took them about a week to find these guys. But they had a camp set up. They were cooking steaks. C-130 carries a lot of survival rations.
Yeah, well, there weren't that many rations on.
No, not on R-4D.
Not on R-4D.
Well, there's a trade-off. Fuel for rations. You know, most pilots will pick fuel to go further.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's I'm glad you mentioned that, because both Max and John have discussed it as well in their interviews. But we didn't know what happened on the. I didn't know what happened on the ground. I didn't think to ask what caused it. I assumed that it was a bad engine.
I don't, at this point, know why they suspect a bad engine. They must, but anyway, that's no point in taking him.
Yeah.
That's my.
Max said that he told him to turn around because they're over open water, but head for the ice when they first started having trouble, because the ice is safety. Come down the water, you're not going to last long.
Go on.
So, You said that you closed the Suitland office in 1960. Yeah, you
had Arlington office.
Arlington, I'm sorry.
In 80.
Arlington office 80. You had a big library there, as I recall.
A moderate one.
Moderate one, yeah.
And I gave it away. Most of it went to George Washington University. And I imagine a fair amount of it went into the dumpster. The Institute, mind you, the joint corporation, the Arctic Institute's principal library was in Montreal, in the Montreal office. While they were in Montreal, the Canadian corporation has since moved to Calgary, took the library with him. But they made that move. The Montreal office, I think, was established in 47, about the same time as the Baltimore one. Because it was the same body of people, World War II types that had been involved in the polar regions, that wanted to ensure that as much of the information that they had garnered about the region was maintained in an accessible fashion. And one board of governors ran the two corporations.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be follow the respective national legal requirements for corporations.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd sit around a table and have a board meeting in the name of, say, the Canadian corporation. Tidy things up during the meeting, stand up, walk around the table once, sit down. Hold the meeting of the U.S. Board of Governors, accept the minutes of the previous meeting, and they'd satisfy both requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Same body of people.
Same body of people would fulfill the two.
Mm-hmm. They did that for what, 30, 40 years?
They did that until the Canadian office moved to Calgary. And in so doing, became an agency of the University of Calgary.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still, well, there is an Alaskan office of the Arctic Institute, and they have a board of governors. And there is a board of governors for the Canadian Corporation also. And the chairman of the two boards are ex officio on the opposite board.
Mm-hmm. But where does the Alaskan office, where is it located?
Fairbanks University.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's been in the museum most of the time.
Who heads that up now? Don't know.
I have never had much faith in the University of Alaska.
Well, I haven't either. I had him as my contractor at Point Barrow.
Let's just end it here. We're just kind of wrapping things up with John Sater. So, thanks, John. It's been a good interview. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.